Inspector.
Ready to rock.
This is a major philosophical chapter, and it's also one that features Jeanette. So if I refer to Jeanette as with a pronoun, you'll just have to, you know, pardon me, because I'm a Neanderthal man.
I'll ring a little bell.
Yeah.
Ding 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 ding.
I bet what
Zoom,
I like
Zoom has some kind of sound like that that I could.
Oh, do they?
No, I don't think so, but it would be nice.
I mean, if I took an audio engineering class, I'm sure I could put in all kinds of drops and fun morning zoo crew sound.
We'd finally be cool, is what
toilet you're flushes. Yeah, we finally get an audience. You know.
Yeah, exactly.
Aougas and toilet flushes and just fun stuff like that.
That would be great.
There's so much great stuff about this chapter, Swan and the Inspector, not least that the inspector sits up on the table on a little cushion, I'm not sure, a little cat.
Yeah. On a plush brought for the purpose.
There you go.
And afterwards lounged there on one elbow with a drink. So they spoke eye to eye. It was a little like talking to a cat. A friend of mine texted me the other week, I identify as a small.
Oh yeah.
I was like, yeah, I get that.
I mean, this is just the Cheshire Cat.
It is the Alice
in Wonderland cat. Here.
Yeah.
In just a wonderful way. So I think of Jeanette as a proportionally the same, but just shrunk as a person.
Yeah. Right? Yes.
So regular human arms and legs, but just, one quarter size or something like that.
Yes. And I feel like we learn a lot about Smalls a bit later when we have that there's a great action sequence with the Smalls that I really love. But also I think we've already learned that Smalls tend to be quite good looking. And one thing in this chapter is that at some point Swan looks at Jeanette and is like, ooh, Jeanette looks tired and frazzled, which is very unusual,
He's got his ponytail is kind of got some.
Exactly. Because usually
Jeanette's ponytail has got some threads out of whack.
Flyaways. Usually Jeanette is very put together. I love the image of just being no, you don't need to make special furniture. I will simply sit on the table with a little plush thing that I can lean on. I really enjoy that a lot.
Carry this plush around with me.
And I love your Alice in Wonderland comparison, because I think that the sort of the storybookness of Swan and Toad, is just kind of delightful. I mean, and this is actually this is a super creepy chapter. I think this is a very in multiple ways, this is quite an upsetting chapter. And Alice in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass are both also quite upsetting in certain ways when you think about them, but then also charming and delightful. And that I think is kind of at work here too.
Well, they both play with the uncanny valley so much. And of course meeting these three women who are claiming to be cubes, android cubes, at a tea party in a meadow is
in a planet, in an asteroid that is Mongolia.
Right. I mean, that is very Alice in Wonderland-y, very British imperialist kind of fantasy, moment, the height of Victorian kind of imagination or whatever, in an exotic place talking to weird creatures or whatever.
Yeah.
I haven't read an Alice in Wonderland in a long time. Anyway,
Yeah. Well, and also here, like Swan does have a kind of, you know, I mean, we can talk about this later, but like her response to them has a little bit of a like Alice quality of just like suddenly becoming like extremely frustrated with the whole, like the game whose terms she does not know. Right.
You
know,
yeah.
Just being like, I'm going to push you over. You're nothing but a pack of cards.
Yes. You know? Right. Yeah. 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 Excellent. So Swan and the inspector are what, so what is the action of this? I mean, they're on a terrarium. Oh, and they're okay. So the inspector is taking Swan around the solar system, essentially on this kind of tour of, not exactly a tour. Like the inspector is doing like the work of detection of gathering evidence and taking Swan on this kind of tour to also demonstrate to her like the things that Jeanette understands to be connected in a kind of pattern that will hopefully unravel, the two problems in dealing with the Terminator incident. First, who did it? And second, how can we find and catch this agent without giving more people the idea of doing it, the so-called copycat problem, and more generally, the problem of preventing any kind of repetition of this attack. That I consider to be the more difficult problem of the two.
Right. So they're in an area of the asteroid belt near Vesta. And they're there particularly because Jeanette's theory more or less is that the attack on Terminator comes not from like one large projectile, but from a mob of pebbles. And here, I remember in what's that book that we read recently? Ministry for the Future, the Peb Mob missile also like plays a role. You know, it's a little bit like buckshot or something like that, right? But it gets like organized. And so they're in Jeanette wants to go to various asteroids in the Vesta zone that have been thrown somewhat off course, because their theory is that throwing off course has something to do with the action that launched the missiles, the PEBs, in the first place, that figuring out sort of like the timing and the source. So basically, like they're trying to confirm something. They're trying to further confirm like the hunch that they have about the point of origin of the attack. So on May 242, there were some abrupt departures from the Vesta zone, apparently, and people think these threw the neighbors off course. All these little worlds had recent perturbations in their orbits. I wanted to ask if they had explanations for them. So the abrupt departures has sort of like thrown them off course. So, and this takes, Swan and Jeanette to the Yggdrasil, which we've seen before, which the first time we saw, we just understood to be an asteroid where something had gone devastatingly wrong and thousands of people had died on it. And this time we begin to have a hint that perhaps like what went devastatingly wrong was not human error on the part of the builders, but actually something that has to do with the launching of the attack on Mercury. Mm-hmm. So we get this just like very kind of intense sense of like this asteroid floating there that is a cemetery, is a memorial, with this gash open to space, which the inspector wants to like examine, and Swan, of course, you know, sees that and presumably like thinks of it in slightly different terms than the inspector does.
Right. And the official story for this so far has been, it's so crazy. It's your page like 243 or something. and it, or maybe 245, and my page 216.
What?
Yeah.
It's fucked up. I hate this. I know we've talked about this every single time, but it makes me so really crazy. Mad. Next time we're definitely, whatever book it is, we're definitely making sure we have the same
edition. Yeah. So dim, so abandoned, she spun in some gust of emotion that perhaps came from her poor Terminator. Yes, the little silver figure floating by her said, there was a pressure failure here with no warning. This was a chondrite and water ice conglomerate asteroid, very common. The accident review found a small meteorite had by chance hit an undetected seam of ice in the cylinder wall, vaporizing it and depressurizing the interior catastrophically. It wasn't the first time something like that had happened, although in this case, the rock readers had given it a triple A rating. Usually the ones that have cracked have been B's or C's and were occupied unwisely. So I've been reanalyzing old accidents, looking for certain flags, blah, blah, blah. A lot of people died. Yes, around 3,000. I just have to say that, like, the AAA rating and 3,000 dead, but remind me of respectively the financial crisis and 9/11.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
That all these AAA rated bonds were so good, and then they all just failed, and like the biggest financial catastrophe since the Great Depression happened just by chance. It was no one's just responsibility. One's responsibility.
Yeah.
And then of course 3,000 people ended up dead. It's a kind of like, you know, massive failure of a number of different systems all at once, resulting in this like tragedy, which at the time in Yggdrasil wasn't like, didn't have the repercussions of a 9/11 event, obviously, but like the kind of similarity there is like, not, I can't let it go by, especially in the week we're about to have, when we're not going to hear anything else besides the memories of 9/11.
Yeah, exactly.
But it also brings up the question of conspiracy and agency, right? And like, who did what to whom and where and when and why, and like, is there a, you know, I mean, I think too, it's like, when you were talking earlier about conspiracy, it's like there's this question of, okay, so the problem with conspiracy is that it encourages you to think that there's this kind of great power behind everything, like pulling all the strings or whatever. But then on the other hand, like, there are great powers behind the scenes pulling the strings in a kind of more or less concerted way to corner the market in wheat, or get us into Iraq so that we're like topple five countries in 7 years and like rebuild the Middle East so that we get all the oil, or all this kind of thing. But I wonder and so there are these like organized people making plans, but I wonder if the question is like, giving it the label of conspiracy or whatever opens up, giving these plans the label of conspiracy opens onto a different way of thinking, rather than understanding like, this is simply how power works, or how capital organizes, like how the capitalist class has class consciousness and understands what its interests are and acts accordingly in that regard. But then also like that comes up against the problem also of agency too. Like,
right.
We want to say that the capitalist class has class consciousness, but, you know, do they have class consciousness any more than, you know, the lower classes do? And, or are they just better at like exercising their agency, or because they have all the money, are their actions like a Waldo simply more egregious and more kind of like, the ramifications of their actions have like a much greater sweep consequences are more deeply felt, or something like that. I don't know. Does that all make sense? Sort of.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, like, I mean, I think part of the pro, I mean, I think part of the problem is like, I think that like, obviously, I mean, conspiracies tell us a lot, right? I mean, and I don't think it's ever quite as simple as like, what they tell us is just sort of like wrong, right? I mean, but George Bush did 9/11 only if You think there is like an extremely high level of like effective intentionality that it's possible for a small group of people to put to work in the world over like quite a long time, right? So on the one hand, like, you know, yeah, I mean, it's really true. And it's still true, I think, to a large extent, that like in the United States, for example, people who have a lot of power are people who like know each other and went to the same schools and like emerge out of the same class position. And unsurprisingly, like are people who are connected not only to, you know, like the CIA, but also to like the corporations, you know, petrocapital, right? I mean, like, you know, that is like true, right? I mean, and to like sort of deny that those connections are there seems like foolish, right? But on the other side of that, to like think that like then there that leads to a kind of like a sort of like infallible ability to control history, right? You know, I mean, so, you know, or like, I don't know, like how do we get to like, you know, the, I mean, so I think it's one thing to talk about like the history of like Euro-American, imperialism and colonialism and just simply military adventures in Western Asia, right? And it's another thing to be like, it's another thing to be sort of like certain that this is like, you know, like the obvious outcome of a set of deals done between, you know what I mean? So I think the problem, I mean, in some ways, like the problem with like a conspiratorial account is like the problem is that I think that it leads to one, the idea, if you just get rid of some people, then you've gotten rid of the problem, right? You know, this is the problem with thinking like, well, what if we just like, you know, what if we just like cut off the head of like, you know, every, you know, oil conglomerate, you know, and also like every, like, I don't know, like financial institution.
We right? could go on naming kinds of, not names, but like structural positions in society of people's heads we like to cut off all exactly. day long. I mean, that could
exactly.
be.
Exactly, right, right.
We'd be and here all day.
Well, while there would be certain satisfactions in that, it's also like, you know, like the way that capital works, is really not located, like you can have very powerful individuals, but that doesn't mean that like, you know, the way that the system systematicity is located in those individuals, right? In fact, it's not. And then I think that can lead you to the sort of thought of like, you know, to go back to the moment that we were just talking about in the chapter, the extinction chapter, like, oh, because this has started happening, there's nothing that we can do.
Right. Yeah.
You know, so.
And I think that like, not to cut you off, but I think this is what makes cubes and the pebble mob or the swarm bombs, whatever, or the swarm pebbles, whatever it is, such interesting figures in this book is because they are at once like they're inscrutable the same way that like power under capitalism is inscrutable, but then at the same time they're undeniably there and present and have some kind of agency and effect on events, right?
Right, right. I mean, I think the kind of like you know, like, you know, if people make history but not under circumstances of their own choosing, right? I mean, that's not just the case for like that, you know, that is not just the case like for the proletariat, and it's also not right. just the case for the ruling class, right?
Right.
I mean, like, so, and that means that like inevitably there is like contingency, right? There is chance in certain kinds of ways. But also inevitably the model of like, if you could just get rid of a few people, right? The shadowy power, right? Is just this, is like not very different from, if everybody just knows the truth about how it works, right? you know, if you simply have a wide enough diffusion of knowledge, then it will stop working.
It's the same as the fan. It's the opposite mm-hmm. end of the spectrum of the fantasy of blockchain being able to track everyone's finance, like where every dollar exists yeah. in the yeah, world, yeah. right? That's the opposite end of that is like, well, we'll magically wish away all the worst people in the world and we'll magically track everyone else. Every right. single financial transaction will do. And then everybody will be happy and free.
Right, right.
Right.
Right. And, you know, as like, you know, I feel like climate change is a good example of like, on the one hand, like it is certainly, you know, like we get the like sort of ping ponging between like a particular kind of like liberal position that says like, you need to recycle and, you know, like
change your light bulbs
and like, you know, whatever. I don't even know, you know, I don't even know.
What canvas tote bags. I could go on. Sure,
right.
All the things that I do basically.
I mean, me too. I love a tote bag. To like a particular sort of like leftist position. That's like, it's not individual choice. It is like simply these things, these corporations are doing. But like those things are actually really not separate from right. each other, right? And then the other issue is that the sort of like the transformations that we like shorthand as climate change, we're also talking about like we're dealing with processes that started a really long time ago.
Right.
Right. So the idea that like what can like combat them is simply like, you know, I mean, I don't know, like, you know, there are certainly days in which it seems like you know, the idea that like, you know, that there are like guilt, that there are simply just like some guilty parties that could
the
be
fantasy of the law. The fantasy of the law is to attribute guilt to specific actors and then remove them from society. So that right. then the society and the economy and politics can function as they are designed to do. That's the fantasy of like the law, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and I think that this sort of like, you know, there is a little bit of something about like conspiracy theory, which is, again, like, I don't want to be just like totally dismissive of it because I think it does a kind of work. And one of the kinds of work that I think it does is people just trying to find a way to like grasp what seems ungraspable, right? Or to like make a map of what seems unmappable, which is like the world, right? Which is like, you know, the social world that we live in. But there is a way in which like you can see how like the fix is in is just the flip side of the system works to cite Lauren Berlant, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that those are like, you know, in some ways, those are equally to say like it's out there. It has a life of its own. It has nothing to do with people, or at least not me, right? And like everybody like me is just like utterly powerless. So all you can do is either like have faith in the system, or like have a cynical relationship to how like, you know, it's all fucked or whatever.
Right. Right.
But like, you know, neither one of those gets you very far, right?
Yeah.
On the other hand, like, you know, like conspiracy can like tell you other kinds of things, right?
And how to be skeptical of things that you maybe should be skeptical of, and interrogate, you know, where truth is, how truth emerges, or how like conventional wisdom kind of congeals around certain, you know, ideas or whatever.
Right. I mean, and you know, there's a lot to wonder about 9/11.
For sure.
Just some questions. People are asking questions.
big fans of TrueAnon over here. Big fans of TrueAnon. Anyway. So
I mean, just to like leap back into this, like
yes.
as Jeanette is presenting Jeanette's theory to Swan, and the question sort of gets raised like, okay, so I'm on 248 in my edition. okay, so here's this idea, like you want to get around like the mechanisms for like detecting like an attack or, you know, an accident that are built in to protect a city like Terminator. How do you get around it? Well, you have to have whatever you're sending in come in underneath the detection limit. So that can happen, Jeanette says, with very little rocks, pebbles, less than a kilogram each. Well, if there were a lot of them and they converged only at the last second, with each one coming in from a different quadrant of the sky and at a different speed, but time such that they all arrived at the same spot at the same time, they would just be little pebbles until the last second, right? So this is the pattern, right? You know, like what looks unpatterned, looks random, congeals at the last moment. They could have been tossed from the far side of the solar system, maybe over a number of years. Even so, if thrown correctly, eventually they make their rendezvous, many thousands of them. So a kind of smart mob, but not even smart, just rocks. And then, so the question is, well, how would you do those calculations? And it turns out like a conventional computer would take forever to do those calculations, but a quantum computer could really do it. And then this taps into the questions that obviously Alex and Walram and Jeanette have had about cubes. And is there something weird going on with cubes? Is it possible that the quantum computers in the solar system are communicating with each other, right? And is it possible that then this is like not a conspiracy, but a weird thing that's happening with, you know, in effect, quantum intelligence?
With cubes. And what's cool is, there's a lot of really cool things about that.
It's cool.
About all of this, because of course, you know, all events that happened in the present do originate, are overdetermined by a incalculable number of historical precedents, right? Of like conditions in the past that then somehow oddly congeal into, you know, whatever it is. You know, think of a flash mob. I mean, just like like random people went on the internet and said, I want to be a flash mob today. And then, you know, they all ended up in a mall doing the Macarena, you know? Yeah. So there's that. Then there's like this idea of the cubes and like, you know, that quantum computing and AI, if it's genuinely AI, is like fundamentally unknowable to human beings. Mm-hmm. If it's like a real artificial intelligence, it would be the same as having a conversation with a cat or a rock or whatever, because it would have a fundamentally different intelligence, even though we humans like designed it or whatever. So much so that like they don't even know, you know, like Jeanette has Swan turn hers off, and Jeanette turns off Passepartout. Which is that a reference to something too?
Yeah, Passepartout is the name of the valet in Around the World in 80 Days, the Jules Verne novel.
That's awesome.
I think it means something like a master key, like that. So it's like a little double joke.
That's cool. So they turn theirs off, and then Jeanette says, can you turn it off? And she's like, yeah. And Jeanette says, are you sure? And she's like, yeah. And he's like, okay, I'm not sure if mine's off because I just turned it off, but I don't know how these things work, you know, like, so they don't know if they're off or not. But then even when they are off, Swan is like, Pauline, do you know what we were talking about? And like, Pauline's like, yeah, I could probably figure it out.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's like, they're so smart that they, you know, these AIs, these cubes are so smart that they already know, like, you can't trick them.
Right.
Because they can put things together from context clues and pretty much guess what is being talked about behind their backs anyway. In that way, they're a lot like people. Like when you enter a room, right, and everybody stops talking, you're like, were you talking about me?
Right.
Like, you know, if you ask someone to leave the room, clearly you're going to be talking about that person when they're gone. So the cubes know this, right?
And I feel like this is the sort of like, everything I know about quantum computing, I have learned from Kim Stanley Robinson novels.
Probably should like do our own research, to quote a phrase.
I've read a little bit, but then I'm just like, well, but you know, whatever.
Who cares?
This is why I read science fiction, to learn things. But you know, like one of the things about, at least from Aurora and also from Red Moon, one of the things that like it seems like the thing about like the way that the quantum computing works is allowing for certain kinds of indeterminacy, which then allow for that sort of like reading of a situation, you know, at least as this idea appears in science fiction, that sort of reading of a situation that you were just describing, right? Like putting together like context and drawing conclusions from there, like to work differently than if you're having to do that from a like binary yes or no, right? If there's like the possibility of yes and no or some other version of indeterminacy. So that's sort of like part of how it is that Pauline is able to like make these kinds of conclusions that feel like they have a that feel like they work like a human mind, right? So that she's able to say, well, you probably were just, you were just on Yggdrasil. So I bet you were talking about what happened there. And there is a resemblance between that and Terminator. And then, you know, so like she's able to make exactly like you coming into a party and being like, everybody is now silent. They were probably talking about me. She's also able to produce the feeling of like an intuitive conclusion, right? Whether it's intuitive, whether it's, you know, makes sense to call it intuitive or not.
I mean, it's a deduction, right? Like, I guess, I'm not sure. I can never remember. I learned it one time, the difference between induction and deduction.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
One and Pauline helps.
Piles of evidence. And the other one involves a thesis. First. Yeah.
Well, this is why they don't pay me the big bucks. Pauline is able to also like not only deduce what they were talking about, but also help Swan solve the problem of, you know, why, you know, the calculation error basically that meant that the tracks were destroyed and not Terminator itself.
And not Terminator itself. I mean, and it is just very charming that Jeanette is like, turn Pauline off, because the right. thing is, we don't know what the cubes are doing, Swan. And Swan right. thinks, well, but Pauline's the one who can answer this question.
Right.
And in some ways it seems like she's right. I mean, like they're going to have to ask a cube anyway to figure this out. But yeah, you know,
well, like, then like Swan turns it around on Jeanette too. And, she's like, I'm sure your passepartout is the same, you know, she had already deduced the general topics of what she missed when I turned her off. I'm sure your passepartout is the same. Jeanette frowned, unable to deny it. So yeah, like, yeah, like, come on, what are we doing here?
Exactly. Well, and the conclusion that Swan comes to is like, okay, even if there had to have been cubes involved in order to do the calculations, if the targeting was off, that must have been human,
right?
Human error, right? And then
which
that
brings us back to the question of terrorism and political conspiracy and power struggle.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and then we get to this conversation that I think we already referenced, right? That we're
before we get to that, the beginning of that section, my page 228, which is probably your page 1087 or something.
Yes.
That evening late in the galley, she found herself alone with the inspector, who again was sitting on the table in front of her eating grapes.
I picture Jeanette in this case like very upright and maybe like, you know, cross-legged on the table, like, yeah.
But he's not eating grapes like that. The grapes are the size of watermelons for this guy. It's like two bites per grape. Grape the size of your head.
That is very Alice in Wonderland. So yeah, and then they get into this very intense conversation in which Swan is like, well, you know, why... You know, I just don't understand why this would happen, because we live in what people call post-scarcity. Mm-hmm. There just couldn't be, what could the motive be, right? Like everybody has what they need is presumably what's meant by post-scarcity. And Jeanette says, sometimes I think it's only in post-scarcity that evil exists. Before that, it could always be put down to want or fear. It's possible to believe, as apparently you did, that when fear and want go away, bad deeds would too. But We are more than food and drink and shelter. It seems like those should be the crucial determinants, but maybe a well-fed citizen is filled with rage and fear. I mean, it's interesting to think that like that then like necessarily gives itself over to saying like evil, right? You know, as the kind of like explanation. That seems like one thing that's kind of like interesting about this conversation. Like one is that like post-scarcity, the range of needs that count for post-scarcity, right? Here, food, drink, and shelter. When surely if they're post-scarcity, they're also like, you know, illness seems to be like quite marginal, right? Certain kinds of oppression also seem to be marginal, et cetera, right? And then the other thing that's interesting is the idea that like, okay, well, if you still have rage and fear post-scarcity, then that is evil, you right. know?
Like that would be
like, that's the only explanation.
Right. I mean, but that would be the essence of evil or something, that rage and fear would still exist despite, because also like well-fed citizen, right. With food and drink and shelter, you know, that what Jeanette is saying is that we're more than just that. So that, and that's something to do with our humanity, that we don't, that's not, that those aren't our, the only wants or needs, right. rather.
Right.
That's some other form of fulfillment. And we've just seen a picture of that with Kieran on Venus.
It's right. Like,
you know, his biological needs, the biological question is taken care of. And no one seems to care what your gender is or how you express sex or whether you do or not. That's all, you know, anything goes. However, like there must be maybe, you know, something more. And he brings up this question of the servile will, right? The rage of the servile will. Will is a matter of free choice, but servitude is lack of freedom. So the servile will feels defiled, feels guilt, expresses that as an assault on something external. And so something evil happens. And I've been wondering if every cube is not by definition some kind of a servile will. So Jeanette is back to the question of, are the cubes doing this, even though Swan has determined that the calculation is human error, is right. up to human error. So, right. so we're in a lot of ways, we're in that kind of sci-fi trope of evil humans putting innocent AIs to, you know, nefarious ends or something, or if it's not even a sci-fi trope, it's another kind of conspiracy trope of an evil kind of mastermind taking advantage of sort of desperate people. I mean, what the FBI does to people, right? Yeah, when they yeah, frame them yeah. for kidnapping the governor of Michigan, for example.
Right. By like giving them everything they need to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think this sort of like, the other thing that it feels like is in play here is, if we think about Venus and like what we've seen on Venus, like that looks like a lot of things, but post-scarcity is not what that looks like.
Right.
Right. I mean, and we've seen Earth and, you know, and we know how Kieran was living on Earth, and that doesn't seem like post-scarcity.
Right.
And therefore, like, it seems like even the claim, there's no need to like investigate the question of like, how is this happening? Like, you know, how is this happening if we're post-scarcity? Because if that we includes like all humans and not just like spacers who live not on Venus, or spacers of a certain like class position, then it does kind of seem like, well, it doesn't really feel like you're there, at least not there for everybody, right? And now that may not have anything to do with this particular kind of like, with this thing happening, right? But it does seem like, you know, there are still people who are struggling and over, right? There's still power struggles that are happening.
Right.
Yeah, Yeah. And then so, but then so the question, like those questions about like evil or intent are complicated both by like this just over this sense of like, you know, systemic unevenness that is still there, right? You know, that things are not like equally distributed and everybody doesn't have enough.
Right.
That seems to be actually quite clear. And some people have a lot, you know. And then on the other side, yeah, the cubes, right? You know, like, what are they? What kind of actors are they in this situation?
I think it's really interesting, too, that this conversation is happening between basically an artist and a cop.
Yeah.
Which occupy very different, as uncop-like as Jeanette appears, as sort of intellect, Jeanette is thinking about research tracks, like how would I research this problem in order to solve it, right? So in many ways, the inspector is also some kind of professor or laboratory researcher or something. And in that regard, not in, in certain ways, not unlike Swan, they occupy, we could say, the same kind of almost professional managerial class perspective in a certain sense. But like the figure of artist and the position of artist and the figure and position of cop in society, they, you know, you obviously see the world in very different ways, so that Jeanette is exposed to evil constantly, right? Swan says, most people try to do good. You see that. And Jeanette responds, not in my line of work. That must change your perspective. It does. And you see the same self-justifications over and over. It's even known which part of the brain are involved in the justifications. Their parts near the religious, blah, blah, blah. So especially with Swan confronting this, you know, cop who sees like the bad that people do, the artist, the perspective of the artist, particularly one who, like Swan, is able to do these like incredibly fantastical things, jetting all around the solar system, putting her body in harm's way, really doing violence to it in the name of self-expression, versus, and like elective violence, essentially, versus Jeanette, who presumably sees a lot of unelective violence in his line of, in Jeanette's line of work, in the line of work of an inspector, right? It's really an interesting kind of perspective because, you know, as good lefties, we want to like abolish the police and everything like that. But at the same time, like there are these, the evil that people do has to be viewed by somebody somewhere at some time. And then that gives, you know, that like changes the perspective of that individual, right? Or that class of individuals on what's possible and what human nature is. I just think that like, especially with regard to Swan, you know, she has a kind of, there's a way in which she has a very naive view of human nature because she's afforded all the possibilities that she's afforded, right? And then, and she has that attitude toward Earth where it's like, but we do such good things for them. We're helping them. And meanwhile, you know, as we've seen on Earth and on Venus, like things are, you know, what are they doing to help these kind of like really radically bad situations?
I mean, I guess my question is still just like, why is this a matter? Why is this a question about human nature, right? Mm. I mean, I see how that question gets posed here, but it does kind of seem like, I mean, they get to, you know, Jeanette complains that like, because there is no universal law, there's an act, you know, there's some accidental libertarian free for all, right? And, you know, like, but it seems like a little bit to like attribute the, like, the question of like, I mean, and so if there is no universal law, then there's also a sort of question about what's getting enforced by the police anyway, I think. But like, it seems to me to sort of like buy a little bit, like, You know, the libertarian line is also a line about like nature, right? Mm-hmm. You know, that like people need to be allowed to act in accord with their nature. And so you create situations in which like, if everybody gets to act in accord with their name, right? So I think the thing that I wonder in this conversation is like, it's not clear to me at all that, like whatever it is that has caused, I mean, you know, the act of destroying Terminator is an act of like incredible cruelty, mm-hmm. but it a little bit seems reductive to me to think that like this has to be a question about like, you know, some sort of like natural tendency in humans, when it seems like it might actually quite well be a political question, you know, and that Swan thinks, oh, we're post-politics, right? And in a certain kind of way, I think Jeanette thinks like we don't have enough politics because like we don't have something like universal law, right? Those aren't exactly the same, like, you know, but whatever, just like little hand wavy there, but you know what I mean, right? You know,
it makes sense. Like Swan is like, everybody acts commonsensically, right? They don't do bad things like this. And Jeanette is like, no, there is no common sense. There is only law. In a certain way, like those are the extreme positions. Anyway, go ahead.
Right. Well, I mean, and you know, like, so that I think, and obviously, like Swan also knows that there's still bad feeling,
right?
You know, I mean, because a big part of like what, you know, as she has moved on from like designing biomes to try to like foster and maintain to like either zoos or inoculants, like what she's moved on to is like the expression of bad feeling, right? You know, and it's, you know, the way it is, the way it's lodged in the body, or to like unlodge it from the body so that others can like see it, right? Or vicariously experience it or whatever it might be. So just like, you know, I'm suspicious of the terms on which the conversation are happening. And then I think you raised the other thing that's weird about it, right? Because like, if the cubes are involved, then surely like their motives can't be attributed. I mean, their motives definitely, whether they could have motive or not is a question. And that motive could not be attributed to human nature, unless you think that like their programming done by humans gives like the artificial intelligence a version of human, a kind of second nature version of human nature, right? But even then, I feel like getting, you know, like turning it into the question of evil seems to me to be like, this is like an overdetermined way to say there need to be police, right? Which, you know, I get that why Jeanette thinks that, because it's like Jeanette's job, right? but a little bit, it doesn't totally feel like we need to like think that here, because it also seems like there could be a lot of reasons that this has happened. Now, I'm not saying they would be good reasons, or that it's a good thing to do, or that they are, that it's like justified. I'm just saying like, it doesn't have to be about like, that sort of like, is there evil still?
Right. Well, and I think that, So I think that a lot of what you said is, reminds me of my point about what the cubes are an interesting analog or point of comparison to like capital in general. It's like there is this logic there that created by humans that is devoted to destroying nature in order to reproduce itself. And where did that come from? I mean, is that a second order human nature thing? Or is this like a completely separate intelligence that is sort of alien to us that we need to like, you know, drive to extinction in a way in order to save ourselves.
Right.
But of course it can't be either one of those things on its own, because it did come from us. So how do we reconcile that? And it, and like at the end of Jeanette, or like Jeanette's moment here, where Jeanette talks about the Mondragon is a beautiful thing, but there are many terraria not in it. Some of them seriously deranged. We're in trouble. This is what I'm seeing. When you combine political inadequacy with the physical problems of being in space, it may be too much. We may be trying to make an impossible adaptation out here. I feel like that's just a statement about life under capital, basically.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
There's political inadequacy to deal with the physical problems of being in capital, of living in capital, and it may just be an impossible adaptation to adapt what our political systems are and which arise from our attempt to get along with each other peacefully with the economic system that we've, you know, adapted over the last 500 years or something like that.
Right.
It's not like a direct analogy, obviously. It's just a way to map those two against.
Yeah. I mean, and then we get a kind of, you know, that the question gets kind of like furthered. This is on 262 in mine, when Swan is saying, but who on earth could have wanted this? And Jeanette says, there are more than 500 organizations on Earth that have expressed opposition to the idea of humans in space. They usually point out that Earth's problems remain unsolved and assert that spacers are trying to escape those problems and leave them behind. Often the bodily modifications in spacers are cited as evidence of the beginnings of a forced speciation. Homo sapiens celestis has been suggested as a name for us. Some also call it the speciation of class. Many Terrans have not gotten the longevity treatments. Thus, their claims that space civilization is perverse, wicked, decadent, and horrible. I mean, so, you know, on the one hand, you can see how those claims, like, you know, go too far or have like a fundamental conservatism to them. On the other hand, you can see, like, I mean, that idea, you know, like, is really not very far from, like, well, shit, you know, the world we live in, rich people live a whole lot longer than poor people, right? And, like, you know, which is, and like, health is also, like, deeply racialized as well as classed. And if that is not, like, in the way that we live now, you know, like, that hasn't reached the level of speciation, but, like, that creates enormous, you know, the distinctions among life chances matter, like, enormously, right? And here, it's interesting to think that there is both this kind of, like, Earth human and presumably, like, a distinctive class division on Earth as well, right? That can look like speciation, and, like, the usefulness of that way of thinking, right, is what has to be questioned here, right? Is it useful to think about it as, like, speciation, as evolutionary, right? Or as, like, biological? But then also Earth human versus space human. And then that introduces us, like, that sort of, like, leads us into, like, the question of cubes that are not just, like, in the form of computers, but are in the form of persons, right? That have bodies. And indeed, who, as we see in the next couple of pages, have bodies that are pretty, like, indistinguishable from what we take to be biological human bodies. And what's, you know, like, what's kind of fascinating here is that the cube question really changes when we start thinking about embodied cubes, right? Versus when we think about Pauline in Swan's head, which is an embodied cube, but in, like, a weird, weird way. Yeah. Versus, or Passepartout, which is, I think, on Jeanette's wrist, right? You know. And that, you know, like, and it, you know, why it would make a difference that, like, the cube could walk around versus not walk around, in, you know, like, given that it probably doesn't, in theory, like, you know, it shouldn't make a difference in its ability to fool you into thinking that it's a human being, but the door is opened up for, like, another sort of speciation, right? That takes a different kind of path, you know, on a different sort of path than those who get to live, you know, functionally forever versus those who, like, live the 70 years or whatever.
Yeah. I have to mention, before we talk about the Tea Party, the Alice in Wonderland Tea Party, that, like, the relation, the resemblance to the Children of Kali in terms of, like, the organizations that want to do harm to spacers, basically, on Earth, that there is this kind of, like, suggestion of a terrorist kind of cell that you know, a violent sort of external to the normal political motions that is possible here in this world. But we're entering the uncanny valley now with three apparently women having a tea party on a tuffet. I don't know. Is there a tuffet involved?
Well, they're wearing dresses that are described as being, like, Victorian. Mm-hmm. And I mean, so they're, Swan and Jeanette are on a terrarium called Inner Mongolia.
Inner Mongolia, right.
Which sounds awesome. Wild horses and wolves and yurts. It just sounds like great. And then Swan like wanders into part that like, unlike the rest of it, is like very tacky and artificial looking and like highly sculpted with like a manicured lawn. I mean, so she's just like wandered into in this little world. She's wandered, which is, it's not just Mongolia, it's also Inner Mongolia. In this little world, she's then wandered into another little world inside it, where she sees a couple of women who are laughing hilariously, which she takes to be, I guess, like an aesthetic comment on like how tacky this little area is. And the women are like, there are three people up there in dresses who told us they're cubes in android bodies. And didn't we think they could pass as humans? We thought they could, but the two women looked at each other and laughed again, that they were totally blowing it by asking us. I mean, just like very weird, like very weird encounter. And then Swan gets there and starts chatting with them. The tasteless design sense of this resort seemed to extend to the clothing of these three guests. They sat by themselves in long dresses like Victorian crinolines, looking enough alike to be siblings, or yes, even cloned androids from a single model, although one looked slightly more female than the other two. And then Swan approaches them and is like, I understand that you're claiming to be cubes. And immediately just like a completely weird conversation full of inappropriate giggling begins.
I love Swan's strategy here of just like, let's do this, like prove to me one way or another. And one of them, I cannot pass a Turing test. Would you like to play chess? And then they just start laughing, open mouth, teeth, gums, tongue, inner cheeks, all very human in look and motion. But they're all like laughing hysterically, like, and I unreservedly use that word, hysterically. Which is like, the question of laughter is such a great question about AI and like robots throughout probably all sci-fi. Like, can a robot laugh? And can you tell a robot is a robot by whether they laugh, when they laugh, how they laugh, how hard they laugh at something? But Swan has that moment of asking herself that, but then she moves quickly to like the skin and the hair and the kind of physical attributes of these, you know, indeterminates, as yet indeterminates, right? And it just launches her into that kind of constant second guessing of like, well, yeah, we could replicate that pretty easily, or, you know, what is replicable and what is not? And then how would a cube actually behave if they were in a body versus if they were, you know, in a body in a different way or whatever? And the sex question inevitably comes up a little bit later though.
Yeah, well, as always in every story about like, is a robot a person?
Right.
Probably not in everyone, but you know, in most of them, right?
Right.
And like in so many stories about is a robot a person, it turns out that like, I mean, and these are not robots, to be clear. It turns out that the test case is a robot that is more or less feminine. I mean, these are like not, you know, like these seem to be both sexed and gendered more complexly than that. But like, you know, they pass as silly girls, which feels like very much kind of in the inheritance of like, you know, for some reason, when we want to ask a question about whether something really gets to be a person or not, we want that something to nonetheless be female, because course that then the question is always open about whether they're really a person just like anyway. Right.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And Swan, I mean, it's such a crazy scene. Like the location is bizarre. The encounter is bizarre. And And Swan's approach is really weird. I mean, like, she wants to figure this out, but, like, you know, it doesn't feel like she's not treating them like they're persons, you know?
Yes.
At
all. Which is also interesting too. Like, to me, it's like the way her approach to them from their perspective could just as easily make her seem like a cube in a person suit, that like Swan in a person yes. suit, than them.
Yes.
Right. On my 237, she's like, "So you eat food?" "Yes, we eat food. In fact, I have a hard time not eating too much." "Me too," Swan said. "So do you ever think about having sex with me?" Not a thing a person would say.
No. And they say, "Well, but we've just met." That's often when people think of it. "Really? I'm not sure that's true." "Believe me, it's true. I don't have any good reason to believe you," the second one said. "I don't know you well enough for that." I mean, so what's funny, I think part of it is like, part of what makes this scene like really creepy is that the three of them are kind of creepy, and like what they're doing there. And like, if you think that they have like, you know, if you picture them as like, these are like robots with bad intent, then like it feels like very strange. But on the other hand, if you picture them as kind of like, you know, the giggly adolescent or pre-adolescent girls they seem to be, it is really weird to be like, "Are you thinking about having right. sex with me?" You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Which then Swan follows up by being like, "Okay, let's get in the tub." You know, and which allows her to like see their bodies in more detail. And then she like forcibly kisses one of them. Right. I mean, it's like very aggressive and, you know, it's like a little rapey.
Yeah.
And not, and then after kissing her, she like punches the shit out of her. So the, just like the whole thing on both sides is like, this is just really weird what's happening right now.
Swan is a weirdo.
She's a total weirdo. I mean, and it is, you know, like, yeah, it is an Alice in Wonderland situation, but it's also like, I don't know. Swan, it like acts out with them, like in a way that it's not totally clear that is proportional to the situation, you know?
Right. And it's, yeah, it, it's totally strange. Yeah, really inappropriate, because on the one hand, you know, if they were robots, that's one thing. Also just rude. Like,
it's rude.
Like rude, even if you're a robot. Like,
yes.
You know, she's rude to Pauline. But Pauline doesn't seem to register that, or she, or it's just like water off a duck's back for her, yeah. for Pauline. But like on the likelihood that these three people are actually human beings, like, what kind of an asshole do you have to be and to treat people like this? But and it's it yeah and it's not it seems not proportional to the prank that they're pulling, which is just like, I'm a robot. Hello, I am a right. robot.
Right, right. Well, and we just like, I think we're left really not knowing what they are, you know?
Yeah.
But also that's kind of like
Swan resolves that they're people, but right?
Well, she said, as she says at the end, she walked back around the cylinder, looking up at a herd of wild horses and kissing her sore knuckles, thinking it over. She wasn't sure what kinds of things she'd spent the day with. That was strange.
Then she tells Jeanette, "I ran into a trio of people today who claimed to be artificial people, androids with cube brains. I beat the shit out of them." She had it coming, because they were fooling with me. Isn't that like, kind of like what you do with your Abramovics? Is not at all. So I guess, I mean, one way or another, they were, whether they were cubes or people, they were fooling
with her. They were fooling with her. Right. Right.
But also she wasn't sure what kind of things she had spent the day with. Could also just apply to the fact that they're dumb girls.
Right. Right.
You know, like, what, you know, what are these kids into these days? I spend all day on TikTok and I just don't understand.
I mean, it's a very, it's like a dreamlike sequence. I mean, and that sort of supports the sense of it as like, you know, that she has like literally entered into the uncanny valley.
Yeah. And it's like, and it's like literally important that she does so alone, that she goes in, you know, without Jeanette or without anybody. It's just right. an experience that she has, you know, with them.
Right, right. And her acting out at them, you know, it seems like it is linked to feeling anger about the idea that like cubes somehow planned the attack on Terminator, right?
Yeah,
presumably. But like, we don't know who these people are. And it does kind of seem like whether they are like, you know, fully biologically human people or whether they are cube people, like they probably don't deserve to be forcibly kissed and then like punched.
It's like for sure.
But it's such an interesting like
it's a harmless prank one way or another.
Yeah,
but she
takes
it very personally because of things that are going on with her.
But it's such a like crazy ending, and like you really are, I think, left very uncertain. And uncertain whether you're grasping the situation, like in a way that kind of like, are you interpreting this accurately? Is this connected to anything else?
Right.
Like if, you know, like if you're sort of like following the bigger logic, you might well be tempted to feel like, ooh, you know, is this connected? Right. You know,
Well, yeah, we still don't know what the deal is with the figure that was on the moon of Jupiter that fell into the lava or whatever.
Right, right, exactly.
But yeah, Swan at the end of the chapter, you know, I think they were people. Anyway, say they weren't. What's the problem with these things if things they are? Jeanette says, the problem is cubes getting out in the world, moving around and doing things. What are they doing? What are they supposed to be doing? Who's making them? And since there is a cube component to the attacks we've seen, we have to wonder, do these things have anything to do with that? Are some of them involved? Maybe they all come to one question. Why are the cubes changing? I mean, I think that too, you know, going back to kind of other, you know, readings or analogies we could draw from the cubes to things that we experience, whether it be capital or whether whether it's the masses or something rising up and asserting themselves as the subjects of history. These are just like fundamental questions of like, why does change happen?
Yeah.
And how, and is anybody directing it? And if so, who and why? And if not, then that's even crazier. Like, how does agency work? Like, why are they changing? Why does change happen? Who, you know, is it random or is it agential?
And I mean, and, you know, like here, like something about just the kind of like, you know, the fundamentally ununderstandable nature of other people anyway,
exactly.
You know, like there are 1,000 reasons why Swan might not be able to like get what's going on with these three people who she's encountered.
Yeah.
And one of them might be that they're artificial persons, but like, you know, another might be, you know, something entirely different from that, right?
Maybe they're anti-vaxxers or anti-maskers or Trump supporters, or, you know, they think that, you know, Bernie cost Hillary the election. Who knows?
Well, and it takes, I mean, those are like, you know, those are the diagnosable categories, right? You know, like this is how we know what to do with this person. They fit into this category because they like post this meme or whatever it is, right? Like, you know, I mean, the scene of meeting, I mean, and like, why would it be so weird actually to meet artificial people in a thoroughly artificial world?
Right.
Like, you know, seems like, I don't know, that might, those things might go along. They might have something to do with each other.
Yeah.
But it is like, I think part of what's interesting about this is also like, you know, you said it's like Alice in Wonderland. But it is also like kind of a scary scene, and it's like a dream. It's like a dream scene. You know, they're kind of scary things in Alice in Wonderland, but that, that gives us like, you know, yet another kind of mode in this book too. Right. You know, the sense of having here like slipped into, something of a bad dream, you know, the dream logic where you don't understand, like you're frustrated because like the ways in which other people are communicating are apparently intelligible to those other people, but not to you. Right.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a very, the creepy uncanniness of Alice in Wonderland, and fairy tales in general, is replicated quite nicely with these technological wonders that Kim Stanley Robinson has dreamed up for us. Tune in for another episode of Marooned on Mars with Matt and Hillary.
That was really nice.
Yeah,
that was really smooth. That was,
thank you. This is my radio voice.
You got to be careful with that, though.
Yeah, it's, I got to work on it.
It's only for certain occasions.
Probably, yeah. You know? I can't keep it up.
No.
Okay. Well, good job. That was a very long episode.
Was it long?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my God. Yes. It was quite long. Yeah.
Everyone will, you know, have their work cut out for them to get through this one.
Yeah.
And next time we'll be back with even more.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. More and more.
More and more. Okay.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening. Marooned on Mars podcast at gmail.com and podcast on Mars on Twitter.
That's right. All. Yeah, that's right.
And yeah, see you next time.
Yeah, appreciate you.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Yeah, bye.